This episode of the Golf Professional Growth Project is brought to you by Golf Genius Software. Less work, more fun, more revenue. You are listening to the Golf Professional Growth Project. My name is Dean Candle, and I'm on a mission to help you, today's golf professional, build the skills it takes to thrive at work and succeed in life. I'm going beyond the traditional education that focuses on golf-specific training and digging deeper to find the real skills, the methods, and the tactics that the most successful people inside and outside of our industry use every day to achieve long-term success. Thank you for joining me. While there are a lot of differences between the jobs and responsibilities of a golf professional and a golf course superintendent, in the end, we're both at the facility to meet the expectations of our customers, drive value to the bottom line, and to recruit and retain great people to our teams. When you look at the career paths of golf professionals and superintendents, there are many similarities in the challenges that we face as we climb the ladder in our careers. And in the end, we're both trying to gain the right experience and grow an influential network that will help us land that leadership position in our side of the golf industry. So when you really get down to it, while our jobs are different, our challenges, our struggles, and our successes share many similarities. In this episode, we talk about all of this and more with Tyler Bloom of Tyler Bloom Consulting. You'll hear about Tyler's career as a golf course superintendent, which included stops at some of the most renowned facilities in the country, and why he pivoted his career to combine his passion for the industry with his true calling in leadership, management, and career development. As he discusses his career trajectory, you may find similarities with your own story. Maybe it's time for you to ask some tough questions or make some difficult decisions about your career. Is there something pulling you in a different direction, or does your true passion lie somewhere else than where you're currently sitting? These are critical questions to ask, and it's why I think Tyler's story is important. And finally, we get into discussing the current state of labor in the golf industry. It's no secret that it's as difficult as ever to fill positions in our industry. This isn't unique to the golf department at your club. It stretches into every area at every facility. As a golf course superintendent, Tyler tackled this problem head-on and found an innovative way to find ready, willing, and able team members to the point where he eliminated the need to even advertise open positions. Could this program work at your club and solve the seemingly never-ending labor dilemma? Let's find out. Here it is, my conversation with my friend Tyler Bloom of Tyler Bloom Consulting. I hope you enjoy it. I hate starting out with the cliche, you know, tell us about yourself and your background, Tyler, but I think in your case, it's certainly pertinent and it's a great story. So, you know, what I'm interested in is you giving us a little rundown of where were you 12 months ago versus where are you right now? Give us a little background there and just maybe how you got to that this point where you are here in January 2021.
Yeah, so 12 months ago, I was a golf course superintendent, director of grounds and facilities at Sparrows Point Country Club, east of Baltimore, Maryland. And I'd been there for 6 years. Grew up basically playing the game of golf since I was six. And I always wanted to work outside, be involved in golf. And so again, fast forward 15, 17 years in the industry, had some stops at places like Muirfield Village, Oakmont for the 2010 U.S. Women's Open, Southern Hills for the 2007 PGA Championship, Marion and Sunnybrook Golf Club prior to Sparrows Point. So that was kind of my background, my upbringing, and my track record pedigree. And so about this time last year, My wife was pregnant with our second, you know, for our second daughter. We had no idea what was coming with COVID. So, you know, then kind of move into March, my wife loses her job. We're a month away from having our second daughter. COVID hits and you start wondering what's going to happen. Like what at that stage, I think in the golf industry, there was a panic button. Right.
Right.
And I guess for myself personally, professionally, I kind of was at a point where trying to get to that next level club for myself, I'd been at Sparrows Point for 6 years and did a lot of great things, you know, agronomically, organizationally, leadership wise. And for me, it was about getting back to Pennsylvania. So originally from Berwick, Pennsylvania, and just really had an affinity or affiliation with Philadelphia golf and really put an emphasis on my career to get back to Philadelphia. But just, you know, the chips didn't fall that way. So, you know, kind of building into that, let's call it March, April timeframe, I had started a consulting business on staff development and labor solutions. And we kind of hit this crossroads. Like, I'm at that point, I'm 33. My trajectory in the industry, I think, is still growing. I peaked, as some people say. And I just kind of came to that thought process, like, am I going to be a golf course superintendent in 10 years, right? Am I going to continue to put my time into this, whether it's staying at Sparrows Point or try to get to that next level, which it just seemed like I was getting further and further away from that goal. And so I capitalized, I felt, and took what most people would think is a risky shot, but I jumped into a full-time consulting role in June after a lot of sleepless nights and honestly consulting with my trusted advisory team. I kind of had done the homework before, set myself up with a business, became a partner with the Predictive Index. So I feel confident it was just more about taking that leap of faith. And so here we are a year later, I'm still standing, paying bills, feeding kids, and it's just been a whirlwind. Like just, it's been a lot of fun, no regrets. I absolutely miss the interaction with staff and miss the interaction with members, you know, at Sparrows Point, but it was the right decision for my family and I to, I think, just pivot our trajectory.
So I think the correlation, obviously you're a golf course superintendent. I'm a golf professional. A lot of the listeners are golf professionals, but there, as we know, there are so many similarities into the lifestyle and our career trajectories, the steps that we need to take to reach our goals. You had all those goals, but what signs were telling you? Because I think this is important when people are during their career trajectory trying to evaluate truly what their goals should be, what they're aspiring to be, and not trying to fit themselves into, in my case, oh, I want to be a head pro at a private club. Or in your case, I want to be a golf course superintendent at a nice private facility. What signs were telling you eventually that maybe it was time to pivot? What did you have to listen to inside yourself to know that this was maybe the right thing to do?
Well, I would start by saying that I felt my passion was more towards career development, leadership development, staff development. I think that's really what my, if you really got down to my core, that's what I wake up for every single day. Mm-hmm. But I think like the signs for me were, you know, I was very fortunate coming up through the ranks that like over 30 of my co-workers, guys that I was in the trenches with at some of these places were golf course superintendents at all elite level clubs. Mm-hmm. So I kind of got bit by this bug of feeling like I was always behind when really I wasn't. I mean, I got my first superintendent job when I was 27. That's almost in this day and age, it's not realistic. It doesn't happen often, but I still felt like I was behind and it just like drove me nuts and to the point where it was like unhealthy. Not good at all that to be comparing my career trajectory to other of my colleagues. I was fortunate. I mean, I've been actively involved in the GCSAA. I've spoken at the Philadelphia Club Managers Association. So I've done a lot of extracurricular type activities, you know, as a superintendent. But I think it's one of those things where from a self-evaluation standpoint, And it's no disrespect to the club I was at, but I couldn't get over the hump of going up against candidates from pedigree clubs, if you want to call it that. And it's the same issue in almost every area of our business. And maybe some of it was just my own personality. I've been told before that I'd be difficult to manage. And I don't think in the sense of not being a team player, leadership standpoint, but, you know, I think I'm somebody that has a vision and I'm going to stick to it. That's my upbringing. And you don't compromise. So I think kind of looking at the trajectory of, all right, if I want to get to that next step, I might actually have to take a step backwards and maybe align myself with, you know, some of these clubs that have a trajectory of pushing on assistance. And I just kind of felt like I've already been through that. Why go back that way? Why not pave something different and unique to me instead of trying to be like every one of my coworkers and my mentors, the people who really have made an impact in the industry from a golf course superintendent standpoint? Why not do something different and unique on my own? You could easily sit here and I could come back and say, you know, maybe things at the club weren't going the greatest. Maybe our financials weren't what was needed to excel. You could easily get lost in the weeds and all of that. But I think at the core of it, just it was my passion and an opportunity that I saw to make a name for myself in a positive way and help the industry. I mean, at the end of the day, it was grow the game of golf. And so, you know, I guess I got back to my core values of what I'm about.
Would you put yourself in the category, go back to you at 26, 27, maybe being too anxious for that leadership role that, you know, or do you look back and say, hey, if I wanted to get where I wanted to go, maybe I should have been a little more patient?
Yeah, I had this conversation yesterday with a pretty prominent superintendent, and I said to him, I certainly don't regret where I'm at. I have a great lifestyle right now, one that I'm choosing. You know, I get to make my schedule. I get to work with the people I want to work with. But looking back, it was probably a bit of immaturity and just not being honest with what the industry is becoming, right or wrong. I could have been more patient and probably taking a step back at that point, maybe aligning myself with, you know, I'm going to use in the Philadelphia market. Maybe it's a Matt Schaefer at Marion, a Dan Mearsman at Philly Cricket, or a John Goslin at Aronimink, you know, guys that have a proven track record of, I think, really polishing people, right? I think agronomically I was ready. I didn't feel like there wasn't anything at the superintendent's job that was overwhelming for me. Like, I felt very prepared. I wasn't afraid of a challenge, you know, and I'm definitely somebody who's not going to follow the straight and narrow path. I'm going to take the road less traveled. And I kind of felt, listen, I'm going to get an opportunity here and I'm going to give it 100 miles an hour and I'm going to make it work. And again, I don't look at my time as a superintendent as a failure by any stretch. I mean,
oh no,
you know, and I don't think you did either, but I think for me, looking back, if I give guidance now to assistant managers, it's you have to really evaluate where you want to be 5-10 years from now. At 26, I didn't see myself necessarily wanting to be at necessarily a St. David's or a Lancaster Country Club, a Rolling Green Golf Club. That really wasn't in my sort of vision. My vision was to go to a place like a Sparrows Point, if you want to call it a fixer upper, and make my stamp in Baltimore and then accelerate possibly to a bigger club. It's just sometimes things don't work out the way you think they're gonna. And it's just the way it is.
Because I asked that question because we see it so often in both sides of this business where it can be frustrating when you know you're talented enough to do the job. No matter what age you are, whether that happens at 27, 28, or 32, or 33, or 43, it's frustrating if you know you can do it, but you can't get the opportunity. So you've been dealing with candidates here. You've been talking to people about their careers. I ask people this question all the time, and there is no magic answer, but let's talk about pedigree. Let's talk about it in your side of things and maybe how it relates to the golf professional side. So you had pedigree in your, and what do we mean by that? We're talking about getting those top name clubs on your resume, getting experience at clubs that everybody knows, that can impress a committee, that can impress a hiring manager. You had those on your resume. What was your thought process at Sparrows Point, and how do you coach people to make the most out of their opportunity if they're not at a club with that top 100 name?
So I learned this in sales school, and I think it's so relevant to this, is you have to create emotional and logical reasoning for a committee to buy into you. And you do that based off of three things: certainty in you, certainty in your product, and certainty in your organization. What's frustrating, and you see it, is you see certainty in the person, their product, but it's the organization that they represent. And, you know, listen, I probably have a little bit more leeway here to say it, but clubs can't get behind going to cocktail parties saying that they picked a guy from Sparrows Point Country Club when they could have picked a guy coming from Aronimink, Marion. It's just the reality, right? Mm-hmm. But I think things that you can do to put yourself in a better position are the intangibles. How do you manage money? How do you make $1 million look like 1.4? How do you create incredible experiences day in, day out for members, for your employees? What are the leadership skills that you do? And that could be in an industry role, like you're volunteering for your local chapter. It could be writing for an industry publication, speaking engagements. Those intangible skill sets are important. I think how you present yourself, whether it's your career materials, an online portfolio, just your presence. You know, those are things that, you know, you can work on. It doesn't take pedigree to learn that stuff. It's you, the person.
It certainly doesn't. And I think you can fall back on it as a crutch when you're not in that position and just say, well, you know, I don't have that club on my resume, so I'm not going to push forward. I'm not going to put myself out there. It's also never been easier to put yourself out there. It's never been easier to produce and create content, to make connections on LinkedIn, to start a podcast, to do a video series, like you said, to write for an industry publication, that all of a sudden, if we're putting this in the context of impressing a committee, now you're producing and you're putting yourself out there that you can impress a committee with. And anybody can do that right now. And that's taking advantage of the opportunities that you have instead of worrying about the opportunities that you just don't have right now.
Yeah. I mean, look, I now that I've been involved in two superintendent searches, I've learned a lot of where my shortcomings were. I've learned a lot what I could have done better to get that next step. And I also learned that coming from a place like a Sparrows Point is actually pretty damn amazing that I ended up in finalist for, let's call it, six of the last nine jobs that superintendent jobs I applied for. I was going up against the uppity ups, you know, the upcomers, the proven superintendents coming from pedigree clubs. It's actually amazing I made it that far. And I think that says a lot for the communication skills, those intangibles that really make you a valued leader and a valued asset. So it's been interesting, right? So I feel like I can share knowledge on both ends of it. It's hard. There's that emotional tie for me when I see somebody who comes from not a pedigree place, but they're fantastic superintendents, agronomically, everything. Like, they've got it all. It kills me because I go back to my time of not getting that next step. But I understand, it's like, okay, you've got the opportunity to pull somebody from Apple who's coming right out of the fast track, the system, the processes, the member experiences. You can pull them right away and translate that. Or you get the guy from the local hardware store that sells computers, that knows how to build a computer from the ground up and has to do it on a shoestring budget. Man, there's a lot of value to that. But there's things like we talked about, sales, and a lot of superintendents, I think different than the golf professionals, is superintendents don't spend enough time on personal development until it's too late. Meaning that they may only focus on resumes, career development materials in the months of November, December, January, when the hiring season is, it's too late.
Yeah, that's not exclusive to superintendents. I think it's just the nature of our business where, you know, it's so seasonal for most of us that, you know, maybe on your side of things, you're concerned about developing your agronomic skills and learning more there. We might be more worried, concerned about, or might just enjoy more learning about, you know, new teaching methods and philosophies and ways to help our students and help our own games, that we can forget about that until it's too late. One thing, you know, certainly that keeps coming up the more and more I talk to people about careers, the more and more I hear from experts, is that continuing, keeping that in your head throughout the season, knowing what your shortcomings are, knowing what boxes you're going to need to check next time that job description comes out, that job posting comes out, and making sure that when you're going down that list, you have tangible results for as many of those things as possible. And you can only do that if you're keeping that in your mind throughout the entire season when you have the opportunity.
It's so true. Like, I'll tell you, it was an aha moment for me this year. I was down at Aronimink for the LPGA Championship. And the first morning of assignments, their practice rounds Monday, just listening to the way John Goslin and his staff construct their day-to-day operations, the pride and performance that they have and the attention to detail in that shop, right then and there, I knew what I missed, like, as a superintendent. And I can look back and be, like, brutally honest with myself to say that I put myself in a position to constantly go and network with people like this and do these opportunities, that I get my staff involved to make our product better. And again, I think we did a great job of it overall, but then there's opportunities that I missed. And I can self-reflect and see it's hard to pull a guy coming from an organization that isn't as well oiled, maybe doesn't have the overall organizational, I don't want to say organizational skills, but the polish that's coming straight from a club like that. And, you know, for those people that are challenged with this, I challenge you to go and network, continue to put yourself and reinvent yourself. That's what I did after every time I lost an interview. I was honest with myself, and I think a lot of people aren't. And I kind of came to that point to say, all right, all the stars are aligning here. Like, I need to make money for myself and provide for my family, or I need to sacrifice and take a step backwards, or just accept where I'm at. And that there's nothing wrong with that either. You know, middle level clubs are not bad places to be.
Right. So if you don't like where you are, you only have two choices: either accept it or you do something about it and get yourself to where you want to be. Now, you mentioned getting involved in search. I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about this a little bit. You've partnered with the PGA of America. Tell us a little bit about that partnership, what you've been doing for them, how you've been involved with PGA Career Services.
Well, it was certainly not intentional. It's just kind of an evolving relationship. So somewhere, I don't know where, I couldn't point to when it happened, but sometime over this past summer, somebody pointed me towards them and made a connection with Jonathan Gold, the Northeast or Mid-Atlantic regional consultant. And so we had a very elementary conversation about all the other things I was doing, more from the entry level and mid-level manager level,
which we're going to talk about.
Yeah. And it just kind of was like, interesting, because we're dealing with the same thing on the golf professional side. Might have been a month later, we're on a Zoom call like this with Scott Kimmick, and we start talking about the same kind of initiatives that I was already implementing. And the question came up, what's your interest in executive search? And to be honest with you, I never got into this to become an executive search person. It's a really delicate position to be in, because in one instant you're hired by the club to do a job, and then for me, it's my network's national, global, right? So there's a lot of friends that I can't play favorites. It's not what I'm paid to do. I'm paid to be objective. And so it wasn't something I was necessarily comfortable with jumping into, but, the opportunity came. Two opportunities came here this winter. I took full advantage, and I feel like I was an asset. I feel my – not only just the agronomy side and the technical aspect, and clubs really need help with that in a search. You can get easily lost that we're just going to hire the guy from such and such a place. And it might happen that way if they're ready and they've got the right skill set. But if you make the wrong hire and that person has a mistake, they lose greens, conditions suffer, that one job could cost that club hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars. And so I looked at this as an opportunity for myself to really educate all stakeholders and represent golf course superintendents because it's needed. It blows my mind how clubs run a search without any sort of technical advisory. And it doesn't need to be full scale that, you know, you pick a search firm, but you should have somebody there to help guide you and coach you and evaluate candidates because it's such a big investment. And if it goes wrong, it's hard to come back from. Especially you look at a market like Philadelphia, where you have such a dense population of great classic golf courses, members have the opportunity to go anywhere. It's all about conditions. It's 100% about conditions. Yeah, the other aspects of communication, leadership obviously goes into play, and visibility, you know, I think is really critical, but it's all about results because that's going to overcome shortcomings in communication. Maybe not being the most prolific or dynamic individual. If you produce results, it's going to go a long way. So, yeah, I mean, that relation with the PGA has been awesome. I think we had obviously two really successful search processes. We had great rapport with both the club and the candidates. It's so rewarding for me to hear from the candidates that they had a great experience.
Yeah. And I think that's sometimes missing in these, when a search is outsourced. It can be missing when just the committee does it too. These are a lot of times at private clubs. These are men and women with full-time jobs and they're doing this on the side. But I think as far as on the superintendent search side of things, that having an expert in agronomy when you're looking for a superintendent is so big, so huge for a club. I mean, there's probably not much more dangerous at a club than a green chairman that has a little bit of knowledge, because it gets some authority to make some decisions without having the actual expertise. I think it's definitely different than hiring a golf pro or a general manager, where I think the skills that you're looking for might be more visible in it through an interview process. Whereas through a superintendent, as you said, it's about results, and the product a lot of times is the golf course. And that may be hard to evaluate, and it may be hard to evaluate what they're going to be able to do at your club. So certainly anybody out there that their club gets involved in a search for a superintendent, this is a fantastic service from the PGA of America now getting into more involved in the superintendent search side of things.
Yeah, and give them a plug. I think initially when it was kind of advertised, the PGA of America is conducting golf course superintendent searches, look, we get very territorial because the thought process is, geez, now I've got a pro picking and choosing who's going to be the golf course superintendent. And a lot of that's just outreach and education that, no, actually the PGA is going to help structure the process. Yeah. And they're going to align themselves with experts, whether it's a general manager, a golf course superintendent, you know, and they've obviously got the network of pros. But listen, I'm not going to pretend to be the absolute expert in agronomy. There's a lot of really qualified superintendents. The one thing that I think is an additional benefit, it really is my network. And that network spans across the country in every climate zone, managing all different grass species. So I think I have a pretty good inclination of what talent looks like at all levels. And listen, I'm a golfer. Like I said, I started playing golf when I was six, so I'm a student of the industry. And I understand all the dynamics of the club cultures from every level. And I think that's a value that not many people can bring, is I've been at that elite championship level club, but I've also been at that facility that is teetering on, for lack of better words, bankruptcy, and is having to make something out of nothing. And I think having that perspective is a really dynamic intangible that I bring to clubs to make sure that organizationally they're taking the right steps.
Hey, golf pros. How many times have you dealt with a frustrated customer that was never updated on the status of a special order? What about the member that was never told his club arrived as it sat in the corner of the office for days on end? Have you ever wished that you could have a more foolproof special order process so that nothing fell through the cracks and your customers left happy and satisfied every time? Just think about how that could improve your sales. Golf Genius Golf Shop is here to help. Golf Shop is the only product on the market created to help your golf retail business communicate with your customers and organize your orders so you can provide the experience your customers come to expect in today's retail environment, just like the big box stores and online retailers. Place an order, an email or text goes out notifying your customer. Update the status of an order, and another notification goes out. The order arrives, just click a button and let them know it's here. Plus, you can customize the notifications to match your specific needs. I'm always looking for ways to be more productive and save time. That's why I've been using Golf Genius Golf Shop since it was released last year. I love the efficiency it has added to our special orders. My members appreciate the constant communication, and our staff isn't bogged down sending emails or making phone calls every time an order arrives. I can easily check if an order is taking longer than expected by viewing the special order dashboard, which keeps me up to speed with any orders that need attention. The result is increased sales that come from a more consistent, reliable, and efficient special order process. Put a stop to the endless questions about, did you place my order, or is my order here, and get Golf Genius Golf Shop. For more info, go to golfgenius.com. So you mentioned talent. This is something that you specialize in. Talk about initially in your consulting business, your initial path that you were going down was using programs that you had put into place to successfully solve this problem of finding qualified talent. So give us a little more detail into the problem that you had and then walk us through how you solved it.
Yeah, I think like everybody in the industry right now, finding good qualified people is the number one issue. It doesn't matter if you're in Philadelphia, Boise, Idaho, California. And so as a golf course superintendent, my first 2 years, we just couldn't find people for any position, quite honestly. And a lot could be said that the club wasn't maybe paying enough wages. Maybe there wasn't really the culture in place, but just finding people. That didn't have a criminal background, would show up to work, would take any level of responsibility or accountability was almost unrealistic. So, you know, I felt I had two options, either quit or solve the problem. And so I'm just not somebody that's going to back away. I had a guidance counselor come to my office in the fall of 2015 to talk about a work study program with Baltimore County Public Schools. So different than Pennsylvania, they're county driven curriculum. And so they have this program called Career and Tech Education. And it's really sort of like vocational training, but you can offer it any school, public school. So students would go to work for half the day and they'd go to school for half the day. Or they would do like one day is an A day where they go to school for the full day, and then their B day, they come to work. So at this point, I was kind of like, all right, maybe the thought process is looking back to my experience coming up as an intern at some of these facilities. Maybe it's sort of like a mock internship starting at the high school level. And, you know, I'm a big sports guy, love college football. And I kind of thought, all right, not every kid's going to go to a 2-year or 4-year college. Not every kid's going to go play, sports at college. They're not going to do some of that stuff. But maybe there's kids that come out of school that need to find a trade. They like working outdoors. Maybe they love being a part of a team. They like working with their hands. If these college coaches are making millions of dollars off of 16, 17, 18-year-old kids, granted, I'm not paying them, and they're not going to go to the NFL. But if I'm giving them an opportunity to develop leadership skills and find a career path, like most of us, how we got into the industry, despite if you're in golf clubhouse or grounds, maybe this is an opportunity for me. So over the course of 6 years, that work study program turned into a state-approved apprenticeship program, youth apprenticeship. And so we had 50 students come through this program. And again, we were fortunate. Locally, we had 5 high schools, public high schools within 10 minutes of the club, 2 private schools. So I was pretty fortunate in that way. But 15 of those students are now in the turf industry. You know, wow. So that's my legacy right at Sparrows Point. That's bigger than anything I accomplished agronomically. Was more about that. So kind of what happened as I developed that program, I got in front of other business leaders. They could be in totally different industries. And I don't want to say I became a spokesperson for the program, but I kind of did. So a lot of business partners or businesses in the local area would call me and ask me how I started this. And that's when the idea in my head conceptually of this is a legitimate business model that can be exposed in any industry, because they're all facing the same thing. I learned it pretty quick. But I started getting in front of state agencies and started working with the Department of Labor. And not to get too far into the weeds, but those connections kind of started leading me to other talent pools, whether it was veterans groups, people with disabilities, community colleges, women, Latinos. It's just identifying in your local labor market what that talent pool is, right? But I learned the process of how to do it. The more I got involved again, I started getting phone calls from general managers, golf course superintendents, heck, even club professionals about what I was doing. I mean, I hosted a couple roundtable events where we had the last one at Sparrows Point. We had over 50 people attend. And so I had representatives from Maryland Department of Labor, Baltimore County Public Schools, just educating people about these sort of initiatives. And kind of long-winded answer, but it's important that you hear all because it's all integrated. Yeah.
Right. And it's a big program. It's kind of hard, you know, take some time to wrap your head around, but when it comes down to it, what I've learned from you is that there are many untapped resources that we have at our state and local levels to find people that want to work, that are ready to work, that are willing to work and can be assets at our facilities. They're not going to walk in and be your lead assistant superintendent, first assistant golf professional more often than not. Right. But how long was the apprenticeship program? How long would somebody be with you? And how high up did you have somebody rise through that program?
Yeah. So when I left Sparrows Point in June of 2020, our 2 assistants actually started at the high school level. They were kind of my guinea pigs, if you want to call it that. And they really became my salesman for the program. Those 2 gentlemen kind of have 2 different pathways. One is your traditional assistant golf course superintendent. He has a advanced certificate from Penn State University and is working towards his 2-year degree. And the difference is he didn't stop work. He continued to work and got that education, and kudos to him for prioritizing that. And again, his name is Adam Naravanchek. It's just the most genuine person you would meet. But if you looked at him 5-6 years ago, Adam was that high school kid that had backwards hat, hoop rings in here, a stud right here. He was your traditional millennial. So it's so self-gratifying to see somebody mature who was given an opportunity that traditionally in our industry, somebody would say, no way in hell, you know, excuse my French, but, and then our other assistant, Andrew Thornton, his name is. Andrew has a basic certificate from Ohio State. And then he has, I believe he has HVAC or plumbing certification through an online training provider. So Andrew's track is more of like plumbing, irrigation, maybe more of your typical tradesman journeyman. But when I left at Sparrows Point, he became the facilities manager. So here's a 23-year-old kid. He's still a kid in my eyes. Both of them are 23. That probably most people would have looked at and said, I don't want to spend the time. And now here they have career opportunities, both making $50,000, $45,000. I mean, that's pretty good money at that age. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the two tracks. But again, it just kind of evolved. Like, the beauty of it was our industry got behind it. So we would have local suppliers, vendors come in and do education trainings for the staff. The local community colleges, Baltimore County Community College, had started to partner with me to become a training provider. And again, it's this initiative that's employer driven versus, I think, regardless of what side you're on, we've always sort of waited for the universities to kind of push out these postgraduates. They're just not there. The pipeline's dry. Sure. So, yes, it is. So I created my own farm team, essentially.
Right. And I think that's the way to look at this. It's the more I've learned about it is that you created your own pipeline. You created your own program. In the comparison in my side of things would be, instead of waiting for a professional golf management intern or graduate to knock on your door, good luck if they do, that doesn't happen very often. Mm-hmm. You created your own training program, basically, where you were able to bring these people up through the ranks, train them along the way. That's the apprenticeship side of this, right? And be able to actually get some into some leadership positions at your facility. Now, how many, as you were doing this, how many times did you have to post a job on Indeed or whatever to find more people for your team?
Well, I'll end with the big statistic is, prior to leaving, I hadn't posted a job in 2 years for any position, entry level all the way up to assistant level. And some people would be like, man, that's so overwhelming. Like, how do I even get started? But that never deterred me, because I kind of felt like, again, once I had the pipeline and I made the community contacts and I had some success, the program would sell itself. I wouldn't have to do the recruiting. The product and my people proved that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it wasn't uncommon, let's call it July 15th, or it could be January 15th, on a random day, I'd get a application on my desk with a business card from either guidance counselor, school administration person, somebody from a chamber of commerce. That's just kind of how it happened, right? It's because people knew Sparrow's Point, specifically my department, had this sort of model for people who were looking to change careers, find a career, whatever it may be. And that's what you want. You want to become almost a destination place for employment and look as a community partner.
How do you think this could translate to the golf department at a club?
You know, without having kind of looked at all the traditional models, just kind of thinking all the assistant pros that I worked with, I do think, you know, for clubs like St. David's at that tier or below, and I don't say that in a derogatory way, but I think you almost have to redefine what the role is and what the responsibilities are. Maybe that role isn't out playing or giving lessons. Maybe that role is more event management, merchandising, customer relations. Those are the kind of things that stand out to me. And you really take a step back and keep an open mind that there's a lot of programs that aren't PGM programs that offer that kind of training pathway, whether it's a community college, high schools are educating people and young people on those kind of career pathways. It's just utilizing the game of golf and all the different networks that we all have to offer that. I mean, you look at, I would assume in your industry, similar career path wise, you could go into accounting, like I said, merchandising, social media, all different sorts of technology companies. And I just don't see why it couldn't translate, but it all starts with the leadership team of being flexible to adapt. And if you don't, you're going to be left behind. You're going to be working crazy hours to try to make up, and you're never going to get it.
Well, we're being forced to adapt right now, or we will be forced to adapt right now. We're going through as significant of a labor shortage as I've ever seen in 20 years in this business. Certainly when I was looking for assistance jobs, I didn't get to pick and choose. I didn't get to negotiate. I was just trying to get my foot in the door. I was trying to get them to say yes to me. It's now the flip side of that. It's me trying to sell candidates on coming to St. David's because we're not one of the top three clubs in Philadelphia. As you know, it's a very nice place. It's, you know, in every area, you have your top 2, 3, 4, 5 clubs and then everybody else. And that's what's intriguing about this model is how can we bring more people into our industry without having to rely on universities? There are only two things in my side of things that require true golf skills, and it's playing and it's teaching. Everything else can be peeled out where you could assign those the other skill sets. We've already done it with merchandising, right? So many of us have a merchandiser. He or she is not a golfer in a lot of cases, or maybe they just enjoy playing the game a little bit, but we've peeled out that role and we've given it to somebody who's not a traditional PGA professional. And that needs to be probably where we need to be looking, to your point, as far as to fill these new positions that we can't fill with PGA professionals.
Listen, the biggest issue I think the golf industry, regardless of what department you're at, is it's awareness. The public looks at golf, right or wrong, and this was brought to me from a guidance counselor, as a white, rich, stuffy place that they don't belong. Mm-hmm. Call what it is, and it's a perception issue that I think there's a lot of people that are – obviously, that's not the case. We all know that. It's a very inclusive game. It's a very – a lot of diverse skill sets, backgrounds. It's not that, but the general public doesn't know that. The Department of Labor doesn't realize – the golf industry is an $82 billion industry. There's over 20 million jobs in the country, right? So it's the long haul, you know, it's the long haul play. I think there's a lot of short-term opportunities that could happen. But again, you have to have a leadership team and a club culture that is willing to invest in that, knowing that you're going to reap the benefits after a couple years.
Right.
Listen, if it could be done at a place like Sparrows Point, where we were offering, you know, when I started, average wages around $10 an hour, there's no reason. And I was the one single person running, you know, doing this to start. If I could do it, I think a lot of clubs with the brain power and the skill sets that are out there in your industry, in our industry, I don't see why we couldn't have a bigger impact. Mm-hmm. It's all about getting started. And somebody taking the leap of faith, and hence why I did.
And you have the success behind it to prove it. Another thing that you've gotten into in your consulting business is coaching with existing leaders and managers, trying to help them build better teams, better train and prepare the people that they have on their team, and not necessarily really from an agronomic standpoint, but really the intangibles that it takes to build better teams. So you've been talking to new leaders and new managers a lot and helping them. What are some things that have stood out to you? And maybe you can go back into your experience too. Mistakes made by new leaders in these positions that you think they need to look out for.
I already touched upon it. My own vulnerability is self-awareness. Being very self-aware of what your strengths and what your blind spots are and how that could impact an individual and a team. I think that's one.
Let me just cut in there for a second, because this is a good one. And I don't think you can – I think there's a – I've had this conversation with some people on my team before about being self-aware. And there was a confusion between being self-aware and self-conscious. And they had said, oh, I'm totally self-aware. What they were telling me was that they were really self-conscious about what one thing or another. And that, and I learned this as well, that you can't be self-aware until you actually take steps to become more self-aware, which are hard steps to take, in that you need to ask other people. You need to get feedback about yourself, because if you don't, you're going to get that feedback when it's too late. So I think pointing that out as number one is critical.
Yeah. I remember, last year, right around this time frame, you know, again, and I was kind of coming out of a winter funk of not getting that next superintendent's job and kind of needed to get over the oh, poor, pitiful me's. But I remember my assistant manager, and here we're talking a 22-year-old kid, maybe 23, coming up to me one day and just saying, you know, sometimes I think you need to take a step back and realize not everybody's as passionate about your vision or the vision that our department has. And I think sometimes it might actually hurt you. Took a lot of guts for him to do, but that's the kind of
relationship. He was doing you a favor.
Yeah, he was. I mean, and it's true. Like, I think I could push people off and turn people off pretty quickly because, you know, like I said, I'm passionate, want to be results focused. And sometimes you got to just take a step back and learn and self-evaluate. I would say one of the things that I've recognized, I've visited about 60 to 70 properties, golf courses, since June. And the people who I most admire are probably have the most humility of anybody. And these are pretty prominent superintendents who have been in the game for 25, 30 years or more, who have track records, you know, as good as anybody. And here they are taking the opportunity to meet with me and sort of self-reflecting themselves and coming to the conclusion that they may have actually hurt themselves from talent acquisition and some of the leadership aspects. And I really appreciate it because here I'm 33 telling somebody who's much more accomplished than me as a superintendent and they're, you know, they're humble enough to admit their own mistakes and, you know, keep open-minded. So that's another key thing. And I would also say, like, so a first-time manager, you come in guns a-blazing, right? You want to make your mark. You want to show that you're an expert in your craft, that they hired the right person. Sometimes I think the best thing you can do is just stop and observe before you jump into too much. In our side of it, it could be project management. It could be green speeds. You know, you want to, I hate to say, you want to stroke your ego a little bit to say, yeah, I can do that. And yes, we are going the next direction, you know, the next step. But sometimes I think just stopping, listening, almost taking a deep breath will be better in the long term and evaluate and just be a sponge, you know, be a sponge for all the different learning experiences you're going to take on that first year and not beat yourself up too much.
Yeah, I think that taking a step back when you get into one of those positions, it is so tempting to get in there and feel like you need to prove yourself, whether it's trying to prove that they hired the right person or trying to back up what they said about the person that they hired. Oh, he or she's great. They come from ABC Country Club. They're going to do all these great things. And you feel like now it's your obligation to get in and show them. And I think with a membership, maybe you can do that. Maybe you need to be out front more. Maybe you need to show them with your team internally. I think one of the biggest mistakes you can get in is jump in and try to show them that instead of jumping in and just having this all hands on deck meeting where you now tell them what we're going to do and what the operation's going to be like, what the values are. I'm speaking from experience. I made this mistake. You know, if I had to go back and do it again, I would have met with everybody one-on-one, not just one time, not twice, over and over and over again to build those relationships that way individually over time, rather than just trying to jump in and prove myself. Because especially if you're younger and you're coming in and you're now leading people that are older than you in that tricky situation too.
Yeah. It's, you know, I know it's something to be said about the people that are already there. You know, they have such intellectual knowledge of their properties, of the membership. And instead of coming in with an iron fist and saying, we're going to change everything, maybe sometimes just listening and getting feedback. Changes can be great, but it can also create more stress and more headaches. If you just kind of, I don't want to say, you have to nurture those relationships and take some time to evaluate. A great example for me is it was my first summer there at Sparrows Point. I started July 28th, so great time to start as a golf course superintendent, first superintendent's job, right? So 2-3 months in, we've got our member. Fortunately, it was like late September, so
in terms of growing grass, it was going to get a lot easier. But I mean, I freaking browned out the place. Like, it was firm, fast, shut the water off. And I just remember some of the existing staff, they're like, I don't think this membership's going to be too happy playing this course this weekend. The low handicap players loved it, right? It was a totally different golf course, but I totally shot myself in the foot because I really alienated a demographic of the members that is too much for them. And as much as during that interview process, they talked about firm, fast conditions, they weren't ready for it. And again, I'm not here to like stroke my own ego and think that, you know, I'm better than I am. It's all relative to a club. What firm and fast is to St. David sure. is going to be totally different than Overbrook or Aronimink. It's totally right. different. And the IQ level is different. So again, coming back to, I really should have paid attention and worked with those groups, understood what to them is a great membership experience before just coming out and giving Tyler Bloom's agenda.
Right. It's understanding the results that they want and then focusing there. I mean, because if we're just focusing on the results we think they want, I mean, they can be totally misguided. And you can, in your case, you know, you can make some changes that are hard to go back on, hard to fix overnight, literally. So yeah. Key to get in there and find out exactly what they want by asking questions and listening. So I want to get you out of here talking about one last thing. This is, and just to get your opinion on this, as golf professionals and superintendents, it's not always the chummiest relationship between the two departments, which is a shame when that's not the case. I've been a part of both. I've been a part of great ones, and I've been a part of ones that certainly needed some improvement. Where do you think the communication or the relationship itself, not just the communication, where do you think the relationship breaks down sometimes, and what should we be doing to make it better?
Well, I was fortunate to have great relationships with the pros. I mean, honestly, I think whether it was Eric Brock at Sparrows Point, Eric Schultz at Sunnybrook, I never personally had an issue. What I see, though, is almost like misalignment with what the goals are and how to respect each other's departments. You're both really trying to give great membership experience, but you do it in totally different ways, right? I always took the approach, right or wrong, that we were going to accommodate the golf shop as best as possible. Right. Outside of we had 3 inches of rain, can't get carts out. Okay. But if it was something where I knew, all right, is one or two carts getting off the path really going to hurt us in the long run? But right. And it might give this membership group or this outing a better experience. I was a little bit more accommodating. But I do see it's personality issues oftentimes. Between the two departments, mm-hmm. and it's the little things. It's not just one big thing. It's the little things. It's the golf shop attendants maybe sometimes not respecting the grounds, right? Driving carts like crazy, and then guess what? The cart breaks down, and guess who's fixing it? Grounds department, the mechanic, right? Typically, it's those little things I think over time that get frustrating. Or I used an example before with you: the range doesn't get picked on Monday, and it's a mow day. You know, the club mm-hmm. closed and it's a great day to do range work. And then guess what? The golf course staff now is picking the range. That stuff frustrates superintendents. I think it's critical that the superintendent doesn't leave it up to chance of whatever's going on in that golf course, right or wrong, to be front and center and just own it. So that way the golf pro can really work. And I think most golf pros from what at least the ones that I've met, I haven't met a terrible golf pro that won't do this. I feel most times that golf pros are great ambassadors for superintendents in the golf course.
Sure.
And I think a large reason they do this is because they don't want to hear Mr. or Mrs. Smith barking up them, because the golf pros are the ones that are going to be dealing with the backlash, not necessarily the superintendent. And so I think it's just a respect for both departments. I think where superintendents could help out and recognize is, you know, the golf staff, whether it's the bagroom boy, the cart attendant, they're the first in line. They're going to be the first person that meets that member. And so they've got to do a great job of educating those people. that was my intention every day, is if I didn't see the golf pro, or the assistant pro, but I saw a golf shop attendant, I'd educate them. We use things like we had a video board in the pro shop with course updates. It was using Twitter to communicate, like get in front of it, so it doesn't come back on you. And I think golf pros get put in really awkward positions to defend somebody, and it's not their area of expertise.
Right. So the breakdown, it begins and ends with communication.
Yeah. Right?
So it's communication back and forth. And on a deeper level, it's communication to the point where there's trust of each other and respect in each other's position, that you can back each other up and you're not at odds. It's communicating, knowing that you're on the same page and you share the same goals of trying to produce a great golf experience for your members and trying to, you know, improve the job that your team does in each department. That's, you know, it can't be overstated, the importance of trying to build the relationships through better communication.
I think, you know, whether it's the golf pro or the superintendent, whoever it is, if you get in those situations where it's super tense and, you know, maybe things are going south on the golf course, look, every year when it's 90 some degrees, not every blade of grass is going to be perfect. It's in your best interest to come together and be intentional about going out on the golf course. Maybe it's spending one day a month, twice a month, driving the golf course, play golf together. That's what I did in my relations, is try to play golf with them and see things from their perspective. And, you know, I almost expected, on the same token, if I was going to overdo that, I wanted to see my golf pro come up to the shop, interact with our staff, you know, not just me and the assistants, but the entry level and people too, because they're the ones that are going to make the difference. It's not just me, the superintendent. It's going to be the guy that's on a weed whacker sweating, the guys out in the bunkers. It's that kind of relation that can really go a long way. And I think it would help superintendents kind of break down maybe that silo and barrier to be a little bit more open-minded with golf professionals.
So tell us a little bit about then what you can offer to this listenership, offer to their clubs, and how they could get in touch with you if there's something that that they want to speak with you further about.
Well, like we said, my bread and butter is more of that apprenticeship aspect, and really trying to help clubs create a presence within their community and make those connections to their local workforce agencies. I would say that's obviously number one. Mm-hmm. Leadership training through my own personal experience, and also as a partner with the Predictive Index, you know, it's a great leadership training tool. And there's a lot of different functions within that, but it's really about setting a framework and a structure for your organization, whether it's grounds, golf, club, or the entire club, to really create sort of a team atmosphere and true leadership training. And that arranges from, could be a 4-hour consultation to a retainer. You know, it just depends on each club's individual needs. Search and placement, I mean, doesn't need to be a golf course superintendent or an executive level. It's that assistant level manager that I really target, because that's where the need's at. Mm-hmm. You know, so those are some of the key things, you know, and I think there's something to be said about organizational development. Again, having been at these levels of clubs and my network in the industry, I see what works and what doesn't work. And I think there's value to that. I think there's value to helping superintendents and golf professionals build those relationships from an objective viewpoint. And I think that sometimes that's having those proven results helps maybe break some of those barriers.
Awesome. And how do people find you? What's the easiest way?
So my website's tbloomllc.com. You could find me on Twitter at tbloom_golf. I'm usually on Twitter. That's where superintendents interact the most. We're not as much LinkedIn focused just yet. So maybe in 5 years I'll change that.
All right. Sounds good. Well, Tyler, it was awesome connecting with you and having this conversation. Really appreciate it. And I know we're going to do it again.
Yeah. Hey, appreciate what you do too. To shout out, it's really cool to see, you know, from the golf professional side, what you do to help your colleagues and take that initiative. It's not an easy thing to do and will deserve recognition for you.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Tyler. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Golf Professional Growth Project. Be sure to rate and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and head to golfprofessionalgrowth.com for updates from GPG.